Hello, and welcome to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies.
Thank you for joining us in this, the latest edition of the OIS podcast series. My name is David Ledesma. I'm Distinguished Research Fellow at the OIS, and I'm joined today by my colleague, Jim Henderson, who's Director of Energy Transition at the OIS. Now, for the month of October 2022, we're doing something a bit different. The OIS is running a series of podcasts focused on COP27 and the issues that are likely to be faced at the conference that is being held between the 6th and the 18th of November in Sharm el-Sheikh, Egypt.
Each podcast will consist of a number of interviews with authors of the articles in the OIS Oxford Energy Forum number 33, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. This is going to be published in October 2022. David and myself will both be doing the interviews, and we hope you enjoy listening to them. In this fourth podcast, we continue our discussions on pre-COP issues, talking to Anders Hove on the role of electric vehicles in the energy transition, Jonathan Stern on the need for action on global methane pledges, and with Adnan Shihab Eldin on nuclear power and its future at the COP negotiations.
Now we are welcoming Anders Hove to the podcast, and he's going to talk about his article in the OEF, The Role of EVs in the Energy Transition. Anders, welcome. Now, can I perhaps start by asking, how important was the zero emissions vehicle pledge at COP26, and were electric vehicles the main focus of it?
Right. Well, I think it's important to note that this pledge was just a year ago. So at that point, the adoption of EVs had already started in a large number of countries and many markets. The declaration basically commits to achieving 100% zero carbon passenger vehicles and vans in new vehicle sales by 2040 worldwide and in major markets by 2035. Now, basically, because by that point, fuel cell vehicles and e-fuels, which are the other potentially zero carbon types of vehicles, I think it's pretty clear that EVs are the main strategy that most car makers and most countries would have for meeting that pledge. I would say that this pledge essentially right now looks like it would involve EV adoption, but there's flexibility in case countries or companies wanted to pursue another strategy. In terms of how important it is, going back to the initial question, I would say that there were a very large number of national governments, 40 national governments. There were a number of cities and provinces. There were also major automakers, major investment firms, electric utilities. But it wasn't a universal declaration. It wasn't the Paris Climate Agreement of the transportation sector. There were a lot of major parties left out. The U.S., China, and Japan were not signatories as on a national basis. And no Japanese car makers signed on. There were U.S., Chinese, and European automakers, but definitely not universal in those countries either.
So, Anders, how has the development of electric vehicles progressed since COP26, you know? And also, which countries and companies are leading the way, and are policies being put in place to encourage a move away from the internal combustion engine?
Yeah, I think that one of the important things to note about this pledge is that it didn't contain any specifics, and the national targets for those countries that have adopted targets for 100% EV or zero carbon emissions vehicles in transport, those countries or localities typically have not adopted a clear roadmap for how to achieve that. So I think that having an aspirational target is more or less typical of the stage that we're at, early adoption stage. And I think that those plans will become more obvious as the pathway becomes clearer to the marketplace itself. Now, in that last year, since this was signed, we have seen incredible progress. I think much more progress than anybody could have expected, especially in a few of the major markets, I would say led by China, number one. Now, 2 years ago, China was at about 5% of the EV share of the automotive market. And, you know, this year they're probably going to exceed 25% of the vehicle market. So that's an incredible change. That's coming up on almost 6 million EVs per year sold in China this year. And that's the largest world auto market. It has huge implications for other markets, even though China has been separate from other markets for many years. But Europe as well has seen the EV share pretty much almost double. And the U.S., which has been a laggard and is essentially almost entirely been a Tesla market until recently, even the U.S. has seen its EV share almost double this year so far. And I think that we're on track for the U.S. to pass a 5% share, which is where China was 2 years ago. I think that the number of vehicles that are available on the market is a very important indicator, and that number is set to continue to increase, and that it will really enable a much more rapid uptake of EVs than we probably could have expected just 1 year ago.
Okay, but what about infrastructure? You know, is that a major constraint? And if so, how is that being addressed?
Yeah, I think that just a few years ago, perhaps let's say 5 years ago, people in the automotive sector, people who studied the energy transition, still viewed electric vehicle charging as kind of a almost unresolvable paradox, chicken and the egg problem, where yes, there might have been some hints at a solution. Some of the automakers, including Tesla and others that were adopting some charging infrastructure, some early entrance into that market, but essentially it was not on track. And now I think that we've reached the stage where there are millions of charging points, and almost every major automotive market has kind of a national charging infrastructure. Now that needs to continue to scale up with the automotive sales. So as EV sales continue to rise, the charging infrastructure has to go along step by step along with that increase. But it's no longer at this early stage where we don't know what the charging infrastructure will look like. We can clearly see where there are gaps, such as for people who don't have access to home charging, people who live in urban cores, for example, or people who are going on long road trips sometimes might still experience many inconveniences with interoperability or payment systems, especially. But I would say that in general, the infrastructure is also looking much better than it was even just a few years ago.
Okay, so what do you think we can expect on this issue of COP27? You know, will it be a major focus of attention?
I think it's hard to say, but I believe that Egypt is probably not going to make this transportation sector the highlight of its presidency. So I think that for those within the transport sector or within the energy transition field, there are some opportunities to strengthen the COP26 agreement on low carbon transport. For example, by adding more countries to the agreement, by adding more car makers to the agreement, by adding more localities or investors to the agreement, or by expanding its scope to become perhaps a little bit more specific on what specifically the pathway for low carbon transport would entail. For example, could it entail some additional integration between low carbon transport and the power grid if we think that EVs are going to be the main solution for low carbon transport? Or are we going to have to specify something about how low carbon transport will be achieved in terms of the percentage of electricity that's coming from renewables? There could be some potential to make the agreement a little bit more specific and I guess add some extra ambition on top. But I wouldn't anticipate that this would be a major focus of the Egyptian presidency.
Well, Anders, you know, thank you very much for your fascinating discussion today. Now we are welcoming Jonathan Stern to the podcast, and he's going to talk about his article in the OEF, The Global Methane Pledge and Need for Action. Jonathan, welcome. Now, can you perhaps start by talking about the Global Methane Pledge and how it became a major focus at COP26?
Yes, thanks, David. So the Global Methane Pledge is a collective effort to reduce global methane emissions by at least 30% from 2020 levels by 2030. And that could really help eliminate around 0.2 degrees centigrade warming by 2050, which may not sound very much, but actually it's a pretty big deal. Methane has become a hugely important issue because it's the next most important greenhouse gas after CO2. And essentially what we're looking at is a global effort to see if we can speed up the elimination of methane and therefore have a near-term impact on warming.
Okay, Jonathan, so what progress has been made since COP26? You know, are we seeing more countries sign up and, more importantly, take action?
So by September this year, the pledge had 122 country signatures. That's an increase of 17 since COP26. And important fossil fuel producing and exporting countries like Egypt, Oman, Qatar, Trinidad and Tobago and Uzbekistan had joined. The question of actions, though, is unclear. What was not encouraging is that the energy pathway, which was agreed in the middle of the year, only provides funding for $59 million, which doesn't seem large enough to make a big difference over so many countries.
Okay, so can we actually hope for further action at COP27? You know, what could be the major challenges?
So the major challenge is that the pledge still lacks some of the biggest global emitters, such as Algeria, Australia, Azerbaijan, China, India, Iran, Russia, South Africa, Turkmenistan, and Venezuela. And of course, the politics between some of the major donors like the US and the EU and several of these countries seem like a big obstacle. So one thinks about China-US relations, Russian relations with everybody in Europe and North America. And it seems unlikely that progress is going to be made with signing these people to these countries to the pledge, given the state of those relations.
Okay, so beyond COP27, you know, are you hopeful that the issue of methane and other greenhouse gas emissions and in the hydrocarbon value chain is now being taken seriously by countries and companies?
So I don't think there's any country or company that would claim methane is not an important issue. And also, I don't think there's any country or company which would claim that they don't need to take action to reduce their emissions. For me, the problem is that as it stands, the pledge is too general and needs specific commitments from national governments in relation to individual sectors and particularly the energy sector. It's probably unrealistic to expect that we will get legally binding commitments, but agreement on some specific national emissions reduction in relation to the energy sector would indicate that governments recognise the importance of methane and are willing to step up their efforts. So if we don't make progress at COP27 in relation to additional signatories, specific national pledges, with corporate as well as government support, and substantially increased financial commitments, I fear that we risk the pledge becoming one of those many kind of bold initiatives announced with great fanfare and subsequently largely forgotten. Given the importance and the urgency of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, this would not be a good signal for progress on global climate action.
Now, Jonathan, you've been very vocal about kind of the measurement of greenhouse gas emissions, particularly in the LNG value chain. Now, perhaps we can spend a couple of minutes just talking about that here today. Now, how is that actually progressing?
Well, and I published a recent insight which suggests that carbon neutral LNG is not really appropriate in relation to measurement, reporting and verification of greenhouse gas emissions. What we need to see is greenhouse gas verified emissions, whether or not these are then offset using the voluntary carbon market. And I am concerned on behalf of the LNG community that we are not getting the required level of transparency on emissions. Now, of course, at the moment with the crisis, a lot of this is being swept off the agenda because everybody is talking about how are we going to get the LNG we need to get through this winter and then next winter. But what I suggest is that this gives the LNG community a breathing space to really get its act together on reporting greenhouse gases from the LNG value chain. And it would be a pity if it didn't take that opportunity.
Well, look, Jonathan, you know, thank you so much for your contribution to this podcast and indeed the Oxford Energy Forum publication itself. Thank you.
Okay, now we're going to talk to Adnan Shahab Eldin about his article on the prospects for nuclear power as part of the energy transition, as part of the COP27 negotiations. Adnan, welcome to the podcast. Perhaps we could start by just me asking you, even before the current situation, nuclear was coming back onto the agenda, even before the Russia-Ukraine war, but have perceptions of its role in the transition improved even more now?
Well, clearly, nuclear power has been playing a role in the overall energy and electricity generation, but it has been challenged over the years as a result, lately, most recent Fukushima. And there was a lot of hesitancy before to enter into expansion of nuclear power, especially in many of the OECD countries, European in particular, before COP26, we had some reluctant countries beginning to rethink about it. But curiously, COP26 did not make any reference to nuclear. Now, the contrast being is that as a result of the war, first we had the emergence or reemergence of security issue to the top of agenda in addition to the climate change. And now you have these two major drivers helping to drive nuclear power back into the agenda. And I think we have seen policies already in many countries and regions. For example, in Europe in particular, we have seen legislation in June by the European Parliament to include nuclear in the taxonomy for sustainable technologies. And in fact, the vote was larger than expected. And this wouldn't have been the case probably if it wasn't for the nuclear war. But the debate was already starting before on account of net zero emission by 2050. And of course, we saw even ministers writing to the European Commission and telling them that we need to do that. 10 European ministers wrote and said to the Commission saying to stay on course for decarbonization and at the same time ensure security of supply, the two main drivers, we need a change in approach to nuclear power. And of course, we've seen that in many individual countries changing their position. Belgium, for example, that had a phase-out decision. Now it has been revised to extend the lifetime of its operating nuclear power by 10 years. The South Korea also reversed its phase-out policy. The UK is now announcing it will add 8 new nuclear power by 2030. That's probably very ambitious. France, which was thinking about a proposal to shut 14 reactors, the president is now calling for 6 to 8 nuclear powers to come in. Japan Prime Minister is now in favor. Australia, out of all countries, anti-nuclear tradition, now thinking the new election and the alliance of the two parties saying is that we will consider nuclear as part of the equation. Even small or newcomer countries are beginning to speak more vocally, like Slovenia now is thinking about renewal plus nuclear instead of renewal plus gas. And Poland, Latvia, and Serbia plan proposals to add nuclear power, some of them in terms of small and modular reactors. And so even in countries that still have a strong opposition to nuclear power, like Germany, reluctantly they announced that two out of the three power reactors in Germany, that were the last three to remain operating, they will be phased out. So you could see that happening.
Okay, I mean, and can nuclear power really provide those countries with energy security and independence, given that there's a relatively small number of companies and countries involved in some pretty key parts of the value chain?
Well, of course, if we're looking at an immediate contribution? No, the answer is definitely no. And the number of suppliers today, if you want to order a reactor or nuclear power plant, the number of suppliers are 2 or 3, and mainly China, Russia. And of course, with a nuclear war, with a war with Russia and Ukraine, Russia is not going to be sought after for the time being. China is offering, but of course, The bet is not on the large nuclear power reactors. The bet is on the new sort of offers that are coming to the market in the next few years in terms of the small and modular reactors. And these will be available from a variety of vendors. Like in the US, there are a number of them. I'm not going to mention name too many names. NuScale, TerraPower, what have you. In the UK, Rolls-Royce, what have you. China is offering SMR. There are currently only 2 operating SMR and 3 under construction. But I think over the next 3-4 years, we're going to see many more available and many more options. So that would be the case. I would suspect for a country like Saudi Arabia today that is about to place an order for 2 nuclear power reactors, they will go with a large vendors, and probably their choices are limited to France, Russia, Japan, maybe China, maybe the US will see an entry. But currently the options are limited.
Okay, and so do you expect nuclear power to be a key area of discussion at COP27, given what you're saying about the prospects? how is it going to be brought up the agenda at the COP?
Well, let me give you a contrast between COP26 and COP27. COP26, nuclear, whether it is the IEA, whether our vendors, they were not in the inner circle of COP26. They were not in the main hall of COP26. They were sidelines to sort of a secondary hall. And so their voices were not being heard. What I understand, for example, the IEA, I just read recently that the IEA would be in the center, in the hall, in the main hall of COP27. And you could see sort of like a mindset shift, a physical shift. Everybody now is welcoming the discussion about nuclear power. And I would expect COP27 to include a statement. And we have argued for that in last year in our article. And I would expect that this year, COP27 will include a statement, especially that the opposition, traditional opposition to including in the statement of the COPs, some statement about nuclear, was coming from the European countries and the European Union. And I think they have dropped that opposition, and we'll see COP27 coming out with a pro-nuclear, maybe qualified a little bit, but you will see a more pro-nuclear statement.
And so, I mean, let's hope that's the case, but if you look over the next decade, does nuclear still face significant challenges? I mean, particularly as you've mentioned, Russia's one of the main suppliers. What are the key obstacles for nuclear over the next decade?
Well, obviously, in sort of the war brought in two sides. One side is accelerating nuclear power on account of energy security. The other one, in terms of where is the supply going to come from? And I think for the next 4 or 5 years, we're not going to see any major additional contribution of nuclear power to overall electricity generation. But I would expect that it will be almost like doubling capacity in 30 years from 400 gigawatt electricity to about 750-80. What are the challenges? The challenges, economic, they will remain. You have to perform current nuclear power plant. They have to perform consistently, not one reactor doing good economically and the other one is not doing good. In almost all countries, that's one criteria. The second criteria is that we shouldn't have any major accidents or even an incident, like, for example, what's happening in Ukraine around that Zaporizhzhia nuclear power reactor. If for any reason we see a release as a result of the military activity, we see a release of radioactivity, even if it's a small amount, that's going to throw a monkey wrench in this momentum toward it. I think the third challenge is the small modular reactors, because if they don't come on market at a reasonable price by 2030, you're not going to see expansion nuclear power. And of course, I always say, we don't know what's going to be the black swan, not necessarily an accident. Something else may happen. But I'm more positive, more optimistic this year about the prospect for nuclear power than before. Three challenges, classically, the security, the safety, and the safeguard will also remain. If we violate any one of them in any major country, security-wise, safety-wise, or safeguard in terms of proliferation, then nuclear will be in trouble.
Okay, now well, that's an optimistic note on which to end. So thank you again for the interview and also for your excellent contribution to the OEF, which will be out in October. Thanks very much indeed. We would like to thank all our interviewees for their time and their excellent contributions to the October 2022 edition of the Oxford Energy Forum, which is called COP27, Refocusing the World on the Energy Transition Agenda. We hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies. You can find other podcasts, as well as our written research, on our website at www.oxfordenergy.org. If you would like more details about our energy transition, gas, oil, electricity, or China research programs, then please contact us at information@oxfordenergy.org.